From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for March the 5th, 2017, the first Sunday in March. This is our weekly look behind the politics and policies that make or don't make Chicago the state and Washington run. Time to grab the Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll try to get your day and week off to a great start. Well, speaking about a great start, how about these Blackhawks these last seven games? I mean, unbelievable.
Seven in a row.
Seven in a row. And guess what? We're in first place.
We were all excited in here Friday night watching that game because, as you know, it didn't look all that good as things were going by in, regulation time. And then the end of the third period. Wow.
Yeah, it's just that was the Islanders, and then, as I mentioned to Dave off the air, I personally had great misgivings about yesterday's game against the Nashville Predators, and just because it was back to back games, and then a home game, and then a away game, and a lot of these teams don't do well in that second game of a back to back, and for them to come out and win 5-3. Just unbelievable. I mean, they're seven wins in a row. We're up by 1 point over Minnesota in the standings. The unfortunate caveat to that is that we've played three more games than the Minnesota Wild has played. So that's they have three games in hand.
Well, now that you mentioned Minnesota, Rick, does this mean that you are tweeting and texting and calling your aunt there?
Aunt Joe.
Aunt Joe, right.
Yes, indeed.
I remember watching a game with you a couple years ago, and they were playing Minnesota. That was hilarious, the way you two were teasing each other.
She's not shy either. She is not retiring. That's for darn sure. But now we don't have any Hawks till Thursday is
right.
The next game.
Anaheim.
Against the Ducks. So at least maybe we'll see what the Wild puts up for numbers here in a couple of games and at least get us back so we can kind of look at things on more of an even keel. But, 42 wins, 18 losses, 89 points. Not too shabby.
No, that isn't. We have Northwestern basketball this afternoon.
Yes, indeed. Purdue, I believe.
Yes, Purdue. And baseball continues to move right along here. This time next month, we will be talking about opening day.
Yeah, isn't
it? A nice phrase, isn't it?
Yes. Well, and you, of course, had the great warning about what next weekend brings as far as
yes.
The clock.
Yep. Spring ahead,
yes.
Maybe not such a nice phrase.
No, it's not. It's not. I mean,
but that is true. Spring ahead is next weekend.
Well, and that means that at least it'll be lighter out when we get in here at the mighty Tribune Tower.
It's nice to see daylight at this hour now. I mean,
yes.
You know, dead of winter, as early as we roll in, why, we're lucky to see daylight sometimes at 7 in the morning.
No kidding. But it's beautiful out there now, a little brisk this
morning. Yeah, that wind was sharp coming in this morning.
Yeah, but we're supposed
to. It's southeast now at 12. So that might be a little bit warmer. It's starting to bring in that warmer air.
Yeah.
Because it'll be in the 50s tomorrow.
And, well, we should hit it today, too, shouldn't we?
At 52, they're saying. But 57, flirting maybe with 60 tomorrow again.
Wow.
So that's not bad.
No. And the trouble is, I'm still trying to figure out which coat to wear.
I know. Yeah.
And whether I put on the earmuffs or not, those kind of, I mean... But it's just been amazing, this round of temperatures that we've been getting.
Yeah, and which also sadly resulted in the violent storms that we had last Tuesday.
Yeah, and a great job to you guys in the newsroom and also to the folks out at Channel 9 as well before the storm coverage. That was pretty intense stuff. And, I mean, to even think of the fact of, like, the tornadoes in February—
Yeah, you know, I was trying to really think hard about, I can only recall one other time where we've actually had tornadic activity, as they say, this time of year. You know, early spring, of course, you expect it, April, right. May, and all through the summer. But January and February, I can only remember only one other time where we actually had a confirmed tornado, maybe 18 years ago or so. Certainly not as violent as what we saw the other day, but that's the only time I can remember that this type of weather this time of year here.
Yeah, and that the string of the storms.
I mean, yes.
Just how extensive it was, going all the way down, through the state and down into Missouri. I mean, it was just...
Into Missouri, I believe, down into Oklahoma,
yeah,
as well, and into Arkansas. That was a big stretch of weather that moved through.
Yeah, and... sadly, with the deaths that occurred, because those were just huge.
Ottawa and Crossville.
Huge tornadoes.
Yeah.
And, it's amazing that, thankfully, at least, the way that you can see the storm path and the radar and the technology has gotten so much better. But, it's really literally true when I hear Tom Skilling say, take cover now. Take cover now. I mean,
yeah. No, you don't mess around with this. And one of the things that we saw, one of the images Tuesday night, was a house that had been picked up, and it was an EF3 tornado. That's the final confirmation from
the Weather Service.
The one that hit Crossville, which is in southeastern Illinois. Close to the Indiana border, really, where the Wabash River is, and then the next big city would be Evansville, Indiana from there.
Right.
But that was an EF3, and probably something similar to that went through Ottawa here.
Yeah.
As well.
Well, and as you say, we're moving into spring.
Spring, but, again, in February to see something like this is... definitely unusual.
Yeah, and let's hope it's not a preview of what the spring is going to be like.
Yeah.
Because we just want things to be nice, calm, decent weather. A little spring rain, maybe, to get the flowers going, those kinds of things.
I liked an article that a colleague of yours wrote in the paper. If you, the old phrase, if you don't like the weather, wait a minute, it'll change.
Yeah, right.
The new take on that was, if you don't like the weather, just shut up.
Fair enough.
That was a good article. He was talking about being in Iceland and driving and dealing with snow and rain and ice, all in the space of about 5 minutes, and pulled into a gas station and struck up a conversation with a young man there. And the young man, it would sound like someone in Chicago. He said, "We have a saying here. If you don't like the weather, wait a minute. It will change." All kinds of variations.
I'm sure. Oh, man. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news and weather. Producer Tom is in for Jasmine, who is off to do the presidential tower stair climb today with the WGN team. And producer Tom will field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is manning the board on the mighty 720 as always. Remember, if you have to tune away, you can always find our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead today, after Dave gives us the 7:30 news update, we'll be speaking to Constance Brewer. Constance Brewer is the Chief External Affairs Officer of the Noble Network of Charter Schools. We'll talk about charter schools and some new data based on CPS stats about them. Dave's back with a news update at 8, and then we'll speak to Roger Simon. Roger is a good friend and the recently retired national political columnist for Politico, and we'll talk about all of the controversies that are swirling out of Washington, or Mar-a-Lago, as the case may be. We'll have more news at 8:30, and then we'll speak to Tom Cross. Tom is the chairman of the Illinois Board of Higher Education. He's also the former Republican leader of the Illinois House, and we'll talk to Tom about the state of higher education in Illinois today. as well as the need to fund those monetary assistance program MAP grants. That's all coming up, but first it's time for a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue on this bright and sunny Sunday morning. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and we'll start our review with President Donald Trump, of course. Using Twitter on Saturday morning, he accused the Obama administration of tapping his phones while a presidential candidate. Obama released a statement saying that the president never ordered surveillance of a U.S. citizen. A knowledgeable U.S. official speaking to NBC News said they had no idea what Trump was talking about and weren't consulted before the tweet. But there was interesting wording in that Obama statement. It said that the White House and the Obama administration did not interfere in Justice Department investigations. What does that mean? I guess we'll have to stay tuned. Well, Trump also was on Twitter defending his Attorney General Jeff Sessions and his contacts with the Russian ambassador. Now, remember, here's what Sessions told Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken at Sessions' confirmation hearing.
If there is any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign communicated with the Russian government in the course of this campaign, what will you do?
Senator Franken, I'm not aware of any of those activities. I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I did not have communications with the Russians, and I'm unable to comment on it.
Now, on Thursday, Sessions maintained that he didn't mislead with his answer and that his contact with the Russian ambassador was not in his role as a surrogate for the Trump campaign. Nevertheless, Sessions said he will recuse himself from any investigation into Russian influence in the presidential election.
I have now decided to recuse myself from any existing or future investigations of any matter relating in any way to the campaigns for President of the United States. I went on to say this announcement should not be interpreted as confirmation of the existence of any investigation or suggestive of the scope of any such investigation.
Now, according to White House sources, the President of the United States was not very happy at the fact that Jeff Sessions decided to recuse himself. Now, you know, this all comes, of course, with last week. We had the president's first address to a joint session of Congress. He was measured in tone, stuck largely to the teleprompter, and he urged reluctant Democrats to unify with Republicans for the good of the nation.
The time for small thinking is over. The time for trivial fights is behind us. We just need the courage to share the dreams that fill our hearts, the bravery to express the hopes that stir our souls, and the confidence to turn those hopes and those dreams into action. From now on, America will be empowered by our aspirations, not burdened by our fears, inspired by the future, not bound by failures of the past, and guided by a vision, not blinded by our doubts. I am asking all citizens to embrace this renewal of the American spirit. I am asking all members of Congress to join me in dreaming big and bold and daring things for our country.
So while Trump's tone was different from some of his other public addresses, his ideas remain the same. For example, he once again said he wants to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare.
Tonight, I am also calling on this Congress to repeal and replace Obamacare. With reforms that expand choice, increase access, lower costs, and at the same time provide better health care. Mandating every American to buy government-approved health insurance was never the right solution for our country.
Now, there was a very touching moment during Trump's address when he honored the memory of Navy SEAL Ryan Owens. He was the SEAL from Peoria who died in the raid in Yemen in January. His widow, Karen Owens, was a guest of the president.
I just spoke to our great General Mattis just now, who reconfirmed that, and I quote, Ryan was a part of a highly successful raid that generated large amounts of vital intelligence that will lead to many more victories in the future against our enemy. Ryan's legacy is etched into eternity. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, a day after the speech, a vice president appeared on MSNBC's Morning Joe program, and he was asked by the hosts if Donald Trump would now, in this changed tone, drop labeling the media as the enemy of the people.
I think one of the reasons why President Donald Trump was elected is because he's a fighter. The American people want a president who will fight for their future, who will fight for American jobs, fight to make America strong in the world again, but also, you know, he's willing to make his case and to challenge his detractors when unfair criticisms come his way.
Now, former President George W. Bush, he was on the Today Show last week, and he was asked by Matt Lauer about Trump's persistent criticism of the media.
I consider the media to be indispensable to democracy, that we need an independent media to hold people like me to account. I mean, power can be very addictive, and it can be corrosive, and it's important for the media to call to account people who abuse their power, whether it be here or elsewhere. One of the things I spent a lot of time doing was trying to convince a person like Vladimir Putin, for example, to accept the notion of an independent press.
Right.
And it's kind of hard to, you know, tell others to have an independent free press when we're not willing to have one ourselves.
That's former President George W. Bush. Also last week, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says he's troubled by the Democratic National Committee election of Tom Perez, the former Obama Labor Secretary. But Sanders also says people are troubled as well by the Republicans that control Congress.
One of the things that Tom is going to have to change is to figure out how we elect national Democratic leaders. I'm not quite impressed with the process that now exists. But the bottom line here right now is that yesterday, among other things, there were 150 rallies all across this country, most of them in front of Republican congressional offices, where citizens of this country are telling their members of Congress, have the guts to come out and meet with us, explain to us why you're going to repeal the Affordable Care Act, throw 20 million people off of health insurance, do away with pre-existing conditions. Don't hide. Don't simply run to your wealthy campaign contributors. Talk to your constituents.
That's Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Tap Horn heaves it.
Part of the catch. Puts it up. Yes! Wildcat win!
The coach, Chris Collins, joins us now. Yesterday, we changed the name of the show to the Nathan Taphorn Show. And salute to one of the greatest passes you will ever see.
You know, you may not believe this, but when we were in that final timeout, I told him to channel his inner Steve Cochran.
The Steve Cochran Show.
You guys got to make me look good. Mm. And let me tell you something. I don't have enough Nathan Taphorn in me.
On 720.
Well, you better start passing better.
Well, I could work on it.
WGN.
I'm Trina Webster.
And I'm Dan Webster, founders of ZQuiet. Let me be honest, I snored.
Yeah, he did. Crazy loud.
And I was forced to sleep on the couch most nights.
Dan tried everything, including surgery, to solve his snoring problem.
Nothing worked.
So we turned to experts and created a solution that's a total game changer, a mouthpiece called ZQuiet.
Not just any mouthpiece, one that gently opens the airway where the snoring happens. In fact, it's based on the same technology as treatments costing thousands of dollars.
It allows natural jaw movement so you can talk, breathe normally, and best of all, sleep comfortably without making a sound.
And what's really cool is that it couldn't be easier. Just pop it in before you go to sleep to kick snoring out of bed.
So you can sleep quiet
with ZQuiet.
Z-Quiet fits both men and women. Try it risk-free for 30 days for just $9.95. Go to GetZQuiet.com or text SNAP to 91011. Go to GetZQuiet.com or text SNAP to 91011.
Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Constance Brewer. She's the Chief External Affairs Officer for the Noble Network of Charter Schools.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. And I'm joined by Constance Brewer, who's the Chief External Affairs Officer of the Noble Network of Charter Schools. Constance, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
It's been quite a week for Noble.
It has.
But I want to start off first about this coalition, Elevate Chicago, mm-hmm. which is a group of charter schools, parents, students, supporters of the charters, and some of the findings that you discovered in going through Chicago public school data.
Mm-hmm.
Could you maybe explain some of the things that you found for as part of this Elevate Chicago research?
Absolutely. And again, thanks so much for having me. And I want to make sure we're operating off of the same definition of what charter schools are, because there are a lot of misconceptions out there about charter schools. And so charter schools are free, public, open enrollment schools. And what that means is that there's no admissions criteria. You don't have to test in. We take all students. And this is incredibly important because we've launched this coalition called Elevate Chicago, as you mentioned. That is a coalition of charters, charter parents, students, and alumni. And we recently released this report that showed that charter public school graduates are 20% more likely to go to college and enroll in college. And this is incredibly important given the high need population of students we serve, primarily free and reduced lunch, or sometimes you'll hear the term low-income students. They are primarily minority students, and they're getting this incredible opportunity to go to college, to attain a college degree that we know will absolutely transform their lives.
Now, I guess charter schools sent 73% of their graduates to college last year, which mm-hmm. is 20% more than students who graduate from other Chicago public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there was also some comparable research done as well about Chicago traditional CPS high schools versus mm-hmm. charter schools as far as rankings were mm-hmm. concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have those statistics?
Sure, absolutely. So I would love to hone in on the top 20 public high schools here in Chicago in terms of college enrollment. And so we looked at the schools that are sending kids to college. And within that top 20 list, half of those schools are charter schools. And this is incredibly important because compared to their peers at selective enrollment or selective district-run high schools, students at charter schools in the top 20 public high schools were more than twice as likely to be students with special needs, twice as likely to be students that are low-income, very, very likely to be minority students. And so, again, charter public high schools are serving these high-need students and giving them the opportunity to go to college right there among the ranks of some of the more selective schools here in the city.
Is there a sense among, you know, just the charter networks as they are,
mm-hmm.
is there a sense of maybe a newfound empowerment with Betsy DeVos as the Secretary of Education now in the Trump administration?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I know there's been a lot of talk about Betsy DeVos and what she stands for, a lot of talk about choice, and oftentimes charters are linked to that. What I can say is this, is that we do believe that parents should have the choice to send their child to the school that is the best fit for their child. Every single child is different and has different needs and different interests. And so whether that is a charter school, fine. Whether that is a selective enrollment school here in Chicago, that's fine, or a neighborhood school or Catholic school. And so under that definition of choice, it really is up to students and families.
But with her there now, as and obviously a demonstrated advocate of choice and charters, mm-hmm. from her involvement in Michigan, mm-hmm. I mean, is there a feeling that there will be steps taken by the federal administration that might enhance the abilities of charters?
Perhaps. I mean, this is definitely one of those things we have to wait and see. Again, there's just been so much anxiety over this choice, and I get where people come from, because choosing an education is by far one of these most important decisions that families make. And we'll just have to wait and see, to be honest with you.
I'm curious, given the financial straits of CPS and just kind of the constant drama that we keep seeing when it comes to school funding in the city, as well as the inability of the state to get its act together when it comes to providing funds, how do charters fit into all of that?
It's a great question, and that is why I really want to emphasize to people that charters are free, publicly funded schools. So these conversations that are happening at the local level, that are happening at the state level, these cuts that are happening impact charter schools. They impact our budgets. We will be receiving another cut in the fourth quarter as a result of all that's happening within our city. So, you know, the impact of that is, you know, similar to what you might see in other schools. We have to think about our programming and the supports that we provide to our students. At Noble, where I work, we provide a lot of supports for our students to, you know, get to college and to graduate from college. And so it's important for people to understand that we're being just as impacted.
And so, I mean, that's also means talking to the folks in Springfield, talking to the governor's administration, those kinds of things, mm-hmm. Talking to legislators about impacts of budgets. Mm-hmm. What do you hear? What is the takeaway that you get from them as far as anything? I mean, the one exemption in that previously occurred in all of this budget stalemate down in Springfield was the education budget. Mm-hmm. Now it's caught up just like everything else.
Mm-hmm. And it makes me sad as someone who works so closely with our parents and our students and our alumni every single day. There's not a moment that does not go by where I am not reminded of why it's important for us to figure out what is definitely a mess. And so we try to make sure that our parents and our alumni have the opportunity to share the stories of success within their charter education experience, so that hopefully our legislators and people who are making these decisions can understand the impact of things being the way that they are today.
Do you think those legislators do understand it?
I have to.
I mean, everybody knows the lip service that mm-hmm. education is our highest priority. Mm-hmm. You hear that from every politician, mm-hmm. regardless of where they come from or what party they're in.
Yeah, I mean, I have to believe that they get it. And you know politics a lot more than I do. So I can't, when you see the need and when you see the impact, I can't really wrap my mind around like why things aren't moving faster than what they are. And but I have to, you know, hope and assume the best in these scenarios, because I don't know what other choice I have.
Well, other than waiting another 20 months for any kind of a budget.
Yeah.
Do you think rank and file legislators understand the concept of charter schools?
I don't. I think that, and that's one of the reasons why we formed Elevate Chicago, because we know the best people who can tell that story are our parents and our alumni, and you know, and our students. And so, part of what we'll be doing over the next several months is just like, you know, setting the record straight, like telling the story about the work we do. I mean, a lot of people don't know this, but you know, this past fall, one of six African-American and Latino freshmen at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign are Nobel graduates. I mean, that is incredibly huge to be having that type of impact and sending kids here in Chicago, some of which are deemed to be the highest need students, to this incredible university. Another statistic, in 2016, one in five of African-American freshmen at the University of Michigan are Nobel graduates. In 2015, CPS sent 98 students to the University of Michigan, and 59 of those students came from Nobel, and 39 came from all the other CPS schools. So, I mean, we're having an incredible impact, and thanks to the hard work of our teachers, of our parents, of our students, I mean, we are really working hard to elevate Chicago and hope we can get those positive stories out there.
We're speaking with Constance Brewer. She's the Chief External Affairs Officer for the Nobel Network of Charter Schools. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Joining me here in the studio is Constance Brewer. She's the Chief External Affairs Officer of the Nobel Network of Charter Schools. Constance, we've got a call from Ron, and this kind of, I think, follows some questions that we've also been getting. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, good morning, Rick. First of all, I'll preface my comment by saying I am an advocate for choice. I believe in vouchers. I believe in competition, so I will say that. But recently, I did read an in-depth article about charter schools and the manipulation of the graduation rate when there are struggling students. Those students are expelled and it doesn't go against the graduation rate. So, and the reason I want to bring that up, because if we are going to be making choices, numbers shouldn't be skewed and people should be able to make choices based on accurate information. So maybe Ms. Brewer can address that. Thanks, Rick.
All right. Thank you, Ron.
Yeah, thank you, Ron, for the question. So I would love to see the report that you're referring to, just to make sure we're working off of the same data. But I can tell you that when you look at our high school graduation rates, our attendance rates, our retention rates compared to the district, they are higher on average. And I bring that up because there are lots of data points that show that our students are starting with us and they're staying with us. That said, I also recognize that charter schools are not perfect. As I mentioned earlier, choice should be left up to parents and families, and they got to make the best choices for their child. But we do do everything we can to ensure that we are keeping our students, that they are within a culture of high expectations, that they're safe, because our goal is ultimately to get our students to college so that they can have a world of opportunities that a college degree can provide them.
Constance, on that note, someone texted me that their CPS data shows that expulsion data, that charter high schools had a much higher expulsion rate than traditional CPS high schools. Mm-hmm. Can you address that?
Absolutely. And so there is definitely some opportunity for us to get better every day. And the last that I checked, I saw that our expulsion data for Noble specifically was like one percentage point higher than the district average. And again, because we do and we could not do this work if we didn't care for and love and appreciate every child. We are trying to get better in that particular category and working alongside our parents and our teachers in order to do that. But again, if you look at graduation rates, if you look at attendance rates and general retention rates from where kids start with us and stay with us, you know, they're higher. So we are on a lot of different metrics retaining our students.
We've got a call from Donna. Donna, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Morning. I'd like to know
why not every school should be a quality school? Why do we need charters? Why don't we make every public school in Chicago or whatever, wherever, a quality education? Not everyone needs to go to college if that's your standard. I mean, we need plumbers, electricians. I don't understand the point of having these special public schools. I think every public school should work to make a quality education.
All right. Thank you, Donna.
Thank you, Donna, for the question. I agree. I think every public school should provide a high-quality education for kids. Absolutely. I am a product of public schools. I am a product of I'm from North Carolina, actually. I grew up on in Durham, North Carolina, but my mom was a tobacco farmer. She's one of eight kids to go to college. She just retired 2 years ago from almost 3 decades of teaching in a traditional public school. So public schools are incredibly important, and it's incredibly important that all of them are high quality. I think it's so to your question or comment around college, the reason why we focus so much on college is because at Noble, 90% of the students that we serve are qualified for free or reduced lunch, or I'll use the term low income. And we know that the best way for those students oftentimes to get out of poverty is through a college education. I've seen that in my own family and through my own personal experience. And I see that here in the city of Chicago today. And so if you look at, for example, lifetime earnings during one's career between a high school graduate and a college graduate, you're talking about like $1 million that college graduates make over their high school graduate peers. There is research that shows there are tremendous health benefits, extended quality of life, you know, lots of things that a college degree can do for low-income student populations. And at the end of the day, we got to make sure that our students are prepared for the rigor of college. That's our focus. And if they want to go to college, that they are provided that, with that option. What's unfair is when kids graduate from high schools and they don't even have a chance to pursue a college degree or diploma because they're not ready. That's unacceptable. So we do everything we can to make sure that kids are ready so they can have that option if they choose it.
Although, I mean, I think everybody recognizes in today's world that, you know, in the past, a high school degree was fine. College was extra. And now, I mean, college really is kind of a minimum these days. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to, you know, getting out in the workplace, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, there's some research that shows that since the Great Recession of 2008, 95% of the new jobs that have been created have required some type of like post high school education. And so that's really important. Like, I mean, our world is shifting and we need to pay attention to that. And as someone who serves over 12,000 students across this city, I owe it to them to make sure that for the time that we have them, we're doing everything we can so that they can access those new jobs and opportunities should they decide to do so.
And I mean, and we're not even talking about like even most of these, a number of these jobs are technical skilled jobs that even community colleges are moving more towards offering kind of workplace apprenticeships with private industry or whatever, but they do require a higher level of skills mm-hmm. than just the old vocational shop class that used to happen in high school kind of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we've talked a lot about choice through the context of charter schools and, you know, it being up to the parent to make a choice that's best for their child, whether it's a charter school or any other school here that the city offers. But I think also when it comes to choice, you know, after high school, again, our goal is to make sure our kids are focused on college and have the opportunity to attend college. They are prepared for college. But we do have some, you know, kids who go to, you know, choose other options. And we support that as well. But we want to make sure that they know that college is attainable for them because a lot of low-income students here in the city do not know that.
It's about opportunity.
It is about opportunity.
I want to ask you about some news that occurred this week about Noble and the fact that a group is trying to form a union of a group of teachers there, about 130 noble teachers, looking to organize under a union umbrella. I'm curious what your view of that is and what effects would a unionized teacher workforce have on Noble's network.
Sure. So first and foremost, and I shared a little bit of my story earlier, I respect, love, admire teachers. Teachers are the reason why I'm here today. Teachers are the reason why we've been able to get the results that we have in terms of college enrollment and proving what's possible for low-income Black and brown students across the city. We could not do this work without teachers, and we've been working hand-in-hand with them over the past 20 years since the first charter school opened here in Chicago. You know, we respect the rights of teachers to organize or not organize, and so we will follow this process, and we will see where it gets us.
I know some have expressed concerns, though, that it might, as from the charter school point, that it might crimp the ability of charters to offer the various choices that they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll be honest, I'm not an expert in this. And as you mentioned, this is hot off the presses in terms of what transpired last week. But what I can say is that when Mike and Tanya Mielke started Noble back in 1999, you know, two Chicago public school high school teachers who, you know, just saw a different path for their students and thought that if you did things a little differently, perhaps they could get better outcome for students. And we've seen that through this white paper that we've released. You know, there's something to be said about that. And we're very proud of that. And again, that work would not have happened without strong teachers and people working alongside us. Our parents and our students, they work just as hard as any of us, oftentimes harder. And so we're very grateful for everyone who has made what we've seen here in Chicago with college enrollment and success possible.
That's Constance Brewer. She's the Chief External Affairs Officer for the Noble Network of Charter Schools. Constance, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. It's 8:06 on this Sunday morning. A bright and sunny day on North Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, and this is your second hour of the Sunday Spin. And joining me this morning, I'm very happy to have an old friend, a great columnist, now retired columnist for Politico, Roger Simon. Roger, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's my pleasure, Rick.
Did you retire at the wrong time?
Absolutely.
I still think you have a lot to say here, you know?
It may be a semi-retirement. I'm still tweeting and Facebooking and reading the morning tweets from Donald Trump. There were two
already this morning.
This morning. And then, of course, a statement by the White House press secretary that Trump wants Congress to investigate Barack Obama.
Right. I was just going to read this, that the statement from the press secretary. Reports concerning potentially politically motivated investigations immediately ahead of the 2016 election are very troubling. President Donald J. Trump is requesting that as part of their investigation into Russian activity, the Congressional Intelligence Committees exercise their oversight authority to determine whether executive branch investigative powers were abused in 2016. Neither the White House nor the president will comment further until such oversight is conducted. That's the statement from Sean Spicer.
And it comes on Sunday at about 8 o'clock Chicago time. You know, you usually don't have bombshells delivered early on Sunday morning by the White House press secretary, but Trump is 24/7 in this stuff.
Well, and, you know, yesterday's Twitter rant by the president, you know, early on a Saturday morning, And, you know, I don't know if that was just intended to be a diversion because of how, you know, this White House keeps getting ensnarled even deeper into issues involving Russia and alleged Russian influence, starting with the presidential election.
That, and it has been very seriously suggested, first by Joe Scarborough, that on Saturdays, Trump's daughter and son-in-law, both of whom are Orthodox Jews, have no control over Trump. They are not monitoring his tweets. They're not watching the internet. And so Saturday has become his new day to sort of go wild.
And who were we to know that it would be Ivanka and Jared were the adults in the room?
Yeah, that's a frightening thought. But it's sort of become a hallmark for the Trump administration that people you never thought would be allowed to, you know, direct traffic are now running the United States of America.
Well, I thought it was very interesting, these reports before the president departed to Florida for the weekend, about the kind of heated exchange that occurred in the Oval with Priebus and Steve Bannon and others over, I guess, the whole issue of why can't this Russia story go away, and as well as anger that Attorney General Sessions decided to recuse himself from any investigation involving Russian influence.
One reason that, and we are told that Trump really lost it when he heard that the Attorney General had recused himself for any matters dealing with Russian influence among members of the Trump staff or the White House staff under Trump. You have to remember that Trump and Sessions are very close. And Trump, it is said, was depending on Sessions to have his back during any congressional investigations. You have to keep in mind that the whole Monica Lewinsky investigation came not because a special prosecutor was investigating Monica Lewinsky. It was because he was investigating a wacky alleged rumors that members of the Clinton administration had murdered
Vince Foster.
And when the special prosecutor couldn't find any evidence of that, and in fact said there is no evidence, he went to Janet Reno, then Attorney General, and said, look, I can't find anything on Vince Foster. So let me investigate this stuff involving these rumors involving the president having sex with an intern. And Janet Reno, to the absolute shock and dismay of Bill Clinton, said, yeah, okay, go ahead. We'll change your brief and you can investigate that instead. Well, this is exactly what Donald Trump does not want to have happen to him. And he was depending on Jeff Sessions, our Attorney General, to have his back and make sure that this investigation doesn't get out of control.
But having his back, as you say, seems to run counter to what we think of as the Attorney General being the top law enforcement official of the United States.
Well, that's how we might think about it. It's not how Donald Trump may think about it. And keep in mind that this whole view that the Attorney General was the chief law enforcement officer of the United States, that he represented the people, not the president, is a post-Watergate view. Up till Watergate, presidents used to appoint their best buddies. JFK appointed his brother, Robert Kennedy. It was not considered an office that was a guardian of the people. It was considered an office that was a guardian of the president. He was the president's lawyer, not the people's lawyer. Well, that, as you say, has changed, but I'm not sure it has changed in the mind of our current president.
And, you know, when you look at the rest of this cabinet, what does that say? What does that say about this presidency?
It says he's loading it with buddies, extreme right wingers, generals, and people who want really to eliminate or reduce in influence the very offices they've been appointed to. And it's sort of a plan of weakening the executive powers of the government that Trump is in charge of. Go ahead.
Well, and you know, we've seen it said about, you know, Steve Bannon's philosophy is almost like a deconstruction of the of really the institutional pillars of government.
Absolutely. These guys are not overly concerned with the niceties of whether a Congress should be consulted on this, as to whether the Supreme Court is supposed to rule based on the Constitution, not based on whether they're conservatives or liberals. That sort of got put to rest in 2000 when we found out that the court could be very political. But I think most Americans would like it to be non-political. That is not the view that Donald Trump has openly espoused.
We're speaking with Roger Simon. He's the recently retired national political columnist for Politico. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined on the phone by Roger Simon, a retired national political columnist for Politico, and we're talking about the latest in Washington, D.C. and Mar-a-Lago. Roger, going back to this statement from the press secretary saying the president is calling for congressional investigations into involvement of the Obama administration into wiretaps, those kinds of things. I actually kind of thought that Trump's kind of tweet blast was actually, while it might have been a distraction ploy or whatever, only might give more call to having a special prosecutor, a independent investigation process rather than Congress.
I think that he has been persuaded to believe that perhaps the appointment of a special prosecutor is inevitable. Congress, and by that I mean the Republican leadership in Congress and powerful Republicans in Congress, are not happy with the first weeks of the Trump administration. It's not what they were expecting. They were expecting that they were going to have a bunch of legislation to pass, which would help them in their own reelection. I mean, to us, an election is over. We just had it. We can, you know, now deal with the nuttiness of an incumbent president. But to every member of Congress and to one-third of the Senate, they're already campaigning for 2018, and we've seen when they go home for their town meetings, which we saw over this weekend or the last week, they're getting shouted down by the audiences who are saying, where is the replacement to Obamacare? You know, why don't we have some substantive stuff about education? You know, why are you dismantling the weather service, you know, which in the Midwest is kind of important to farmers and in the cities is kind of important to other people. But it's this sort of continuing zaniness at its best is not what Congress wants. And if they have to appoint a special prosecutor to put an end to it, and that special prosecutor has to take down major members of the Trump administration, then they're willing to pay that price.
Well, and I mean, I know as much as the president may fear that concept of a special prosecutor, it also would seem to be something where the White House could say, you know, instead of having to respond to every kind of new story that comes out about some kind of relationship with Russian influence, they could just say it's a matter being investigated. Talk to the special prosecutor.
Exactly, Rick. And sensibly, that's what would happen. However, we have a president who likes to tweet at 5 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes every day, sometimes including today on Sundays. And he just cannot seem to contain himself. He does not seem, in this Twitter rant that we had on Saturday, he does not seem like a person totally in control of his emotions. Now, we all get upset, and we all have temper tantrums, even adults. But when you're president of the United States and there's no one to say, Mr. President, I don't think you ought to tweet that to the entire world, then you got a lot of trouble. And all sorts of strategies like the one you just outlined might make sense, but they don't work if you have a president who is uncontrollable.
Well, and you know, as we saw yesterday where he kind of drops this bombshell without backing any of it up, and then goes on to note that Arnold Schwarzenegger was fired as host of The Apprentice because of low ratings.
Yeah, it doesn't fit in with the view that most Americans had of their president. It seems like, wild accusations on the one hand, and sheer goofiness on the other, the only thing that connects them is that anyone who Donald Trump feels has attacked him is going to get blasted. And he said during the campaign, you know, you take a jab at me and I'm going to hit you back 10 times as hard. And he says he doesn't initiate fights, but once a fight has begun, he's going to floor his opponent. And that's what we're seeing. In his mind, Arnold Schwarzenegger insulted him. Barack Obama, which he had been briefly kind of close to, also insulted him, or at least members of the old Trump, of the old Obama administration has. So that is enough in President Trump's mind, to just go full blast in his Twitter attack.
I did find interesting the Obama statement yesterday in that the first sentence began that it was a cardinal rule of the White House and this administration to not get involved in Department of Justice investigations, period. And then went on to say that the administration or White House never ordered surveillance of a U.S. citizen and that it would be absolutely false to say otherwise. That first sentence indicates a possibility that there was a Department of Justice investigation in which those phones of the Trump may have been tapped.
You're exactly right, and here is another twist to the problem. The President of the United States cannot order a wiretap. He simply does not have the power to do so. Only a federal judge can order a wiretap. So if there was a wiretap of Trump's people or Trump himself in 2016, it wasn't Obama doing it. It was a federal judge doing it after having reviewed evidence brought to him by the attorney general. So it seems that if you were a president, an incoming president, who was being investigated in that manner. You would not want a lot of attention brought to this. You would want to keep it kind of quiet and maybe settle it behind the scenes. But President Trump is doing exactly the opposite.
I noted that, you know, in response to these tweets yesterday, Senator Ben Sasse, the Republican from Nebraska, who has been a frequent Trump critic, said if there were wiretaps of then-candidate Trump's organization or campaign, then it was either with FISA court authorization or without such authorization. If without, the president should explain what sort of wiretap it was and how he knows this. And it is possible he was illegally tapped. But then he said, on the other hand, if it was with a legal FISA court order, then an application for surveillance exists that the court found credible. The president should ask that this full application regarding surveillance of foreign operatives or operations be made available, ideally to the full public, and at a bare minimum to the U.S. Senate. Then he added, we are in the midst of a civilization-warping crisis of public trust.
Yeah, to those of us who are old enough, creaky enough to remember Watergate, this is so familiar. In the slow but steady unraveling of a presidency. I mean, I know we're only a few weeks into it.
Well, that's the remarkable part, you know. I mean, Watergate was a drip, 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 and of course, Watergate was the deceit, the cover-up, you know, more than the act.
Right. And now instead of a drip, 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 we have a fire hose. We've got this stuff being blasted in our face every day, including, you know, some people, including reporters, used to rest on Sunday mornings, right? Well, now they got to get up at 5 and 6 a.m. and check Twitter. And then when they read it, they got to go into the newsroom and write a story or several stories. It's this and the president and the American people that turn on their TVs and maybe they want to watch sports. Maybe they want to relax. Instead, they get full blast of Trump again in their face. It gets tiring very quickly. And I remember the Monica Lewinsky scandal also. Day after day after day of the same subject, but with the little drip, drip, drip wears you down. Well, if the drip, drip, drip wore us down, you can imagine what this Trump full blast in the face is going to do.
That's Roger Simon. He's the recently retired national political columnist for Politico. Roger, as always, great to talk to you, and hope we can do this again soon.
I'd love it, Rick. Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase studio on a sunny Michigan Avenue. And joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Tom Cross. Tom is the chairman of the Illinois Board of Higher Education. He's also the former Illinois House Republican leader. Tom, thanks for joining me here this morning.
Glad to be here.
I know, you know, from way out yonder how you had to travel in, that you had to probably get up last night at 11 o'clock, right?
Well, this was one of those days where traffic was not bad. But as you know, you never know.
You never know.
The Eisenhower, whether it's going to move. Today was a good day.
And hopefully it'll be that way when you return.
Well, time will tell on that as well. There used to be, if you got out of the city by 2 or 3, you were fine, but now you never know.
It doesn't matter. Well, I wanted to have Tom on the show to talk about kind of the state of higher education in Illinois. And most immediately, the issue of the Monetary Award Program grants. And these are the grants that are monetary awards given to students from low-income families to help them attend college. And these help pay tuition for them at public as well as private institutions. And because of the continuing budget impasse in Springfield, this program is totally up in the air.
It is in a state of chaos. The average family that qualifies for MAP has a family income of about $28,000. So it gives you a perspective of what we're talking about. A lot of first generation kids. There's several problems with MAP going on. One, there's not enough money to take care of all of the kids. And I say kids, that's unfair. They're adults as well, right, that go back, students that qualify for MAP. Back in 2001, I think, was the last year that we fully funded all of the requests. And that would take today about $1 billion if we had a budget. In the last few years, it's been about 350. So you're leaving a lot of students completely to the wayside who aren't able to even, because there's not enough money to even qualify for it. But then again, on the 350 number, if we had a budget, that's not happening. Both private and public schools are suffering greatly because there's no certainty on MAP, and they're not getting any MAP. I work at Aurora University. There was a story in the Beacon News, a Tribune paper in the Aurora area, where we had 45 faculty members were impacted because the school has not received MAP money and aren't sure they're going to get MAP money. So it's bad for faculty, it's bad for administrators, it's bad for students all the way around.
Well, in 2015, which the last year that the state had a real budget, was $364 million was the appropriation for MAP grants. And that went to 128,000 Illinois students. In fiscal 2016, there was $320 million used to pay claims for MAP grants for the fall of 2015 and 2016. But that only funded 107,000 students.
And there are probably another 150 approximately that need it. But because we're so low, the governor, and I'm glad he did it, in his budget address, suggested an increase of about $35 million, which would up that number. But again, because we have
about 13,000 students.
About 13,000 students. But the real short-term issue is schools are not getting their MAP money because we don't have a budget. So either schools are saying to students, we're not, because there's no state money, we don't have the money to take care of it. Or in the alternative, schools that are taking care of these kids in anticipation of getting it are having struggles in other areas like faculty and staff. As I mentioned, Aurora, you had mentioned today there was a story in the Journal Register about schools in Central Illinois that are suffering because of MAP. Here's the problem. If you are a student that wants to take advantage of MAP and there's no MAP and the uncertainty exists, there's a good chance you're not going to go to college when you leave high school. And if you don't go to school that, in my opinion, that first or second year, and I think the data supports it, there's a good chance you don't go to school at all.
Sure, and you end up on a different track.
You end up on a different track. I think it's criminal, but it's a mistake for us as a state not to be committed to making sure kids that want to go to school, who don't have the means, that we should help them to get them on that track, on the higher education track. And I think that's a real mistake for the state. And I think overall for higher ed, we are going to have some real struggles because we're seeing kids leaving the state of Illinois, either because of MAP or because of the image of higher ed or because programming has changed. We're losing them to other states. And then you wonder whether you're going to get them back.
Well, and, you know, one of the things, I spoke earlier to Constance Brewer from the Noble Network of Charter Schools, and it was, you know, what college means today isn't what it necessarily was 20 years ago, that a college degree now is almost just a minimum qualifier, not like the high school degree was 20 years ago. If you don't have that college degree, or even the opportunity to pursue one, you lose out on the job opportunities that are going to exist in this new world that we live in.
It's job opportunities. It's, you know, people talk about loss of jobs to China. In reality, many people would suggest it's loss of jobs to technology, and you're going to need that education to be able to be competitive.
Actually, I think most studies have shown that it's not globalization, but automation is really what's changed.
It's a better way to say it, and you need to do that. You know, certainly there are ways to do that without college, but many would suggest, like you said, you at a minimum need that college degree. And we're taking away that opportunity for people to do that. And when you've got students that want to go to college and have a desire to go and you know, have that income, or at that income threshold where they qualify, and we can't help them. I think that's a huge, huge problem as a state, and it has repercussions in so many different ways.
We're speaking with Tom Cross. He's the chairman of the Illinois Board of Higher Education. He's also the former State House Republican leader. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase studio, joined by Tom Cross, the chairman of the Illinois Board of Higher Education. We're talking about the Monetary Award Program grants and that budget, but let's broaden this out to just the lack of a budget and really what this has done as far as higher education, institutions of higher education in this state. We see stories about layoffs, as you mentioned, public universities. We've got the issue at Northeastern where student workers are losing their jobs because of how they fall in the pecking order when there's furloughs of the full-time workers at a public university under their contract there. It's not wrong to think that there's always been a relative issue of bloat in public universities. But at the same time, with the lack of funding that has existed, you have to wonder, are places like Eastern Illinois University and Western Illinois University still going to be what those institutions stood for, and also what they mean for those regions of the state?
Well, let me just to finish up on MAP, I would implore the General Assembly to get MAP done immediately.
I think you made your point.
Okay, it's that critical. We talk about the state, et cetera. We're talking about people's lives, day to day. Remember when I remember when I was in school, every dollar counted, every penny counted. And when you lose a job at Northeastern, even for a couple of weeks, it impacts you.
Sure.
As a student, it's in very real. But look, to the point of bloat, you're going to have people that believe there is, the people that believe they're not. But at the end of the day, the presidents and the boards of these existing universities, Eastern, Western, ISU, U of I, all of them, they have cut to the bare bones. There's no bloat. They're using reserves, and they've done such a good job where we think, maybe things aren't so bad. But I think we're now at a point where if we don't see a budget soon, not down the road, but now, we're going to start seeing, I think, some very, very bad examples of accreditation issues, maybe not honoring their bond covenants. You're going to continue to see. We have an out-migration problem. Can they make their debt service on bonds? So there are all kinds of those issues that we're right at the threshold of that happening. And the sad part is we have great higher education institutions in the state of Illinois, led by the U of I to ISU to all the ones you've mentioned. They're very good. They do really good things in their own right. And I feel like we're right on that edge where we're going to start to lose more and more kids and question whether it makes sense to go to school in Illinois.
Well, you mentioned off the air the out-migration factor, if you got those numbers handy.
We've lost – the last numbers we had, I think from a year ago, said 33,000 kids left – high school students left the state of Illinois to go to other places. And it's primarily around central – the Midwest, the Iowas, the Missouris, the Indianas, Wisconsin, Michigan. Only 17,000 students – are coming into the state of Illinois to go to school. So we have a net loss of over 16,000, about 16,600 kids are leaving the state of Illinois. My fear, as the chairman of the Board of Higher Ed, is that number is going to continue to grow, in spite of the fact that we have, I believe, great, great schools.
But I would be hard-pressed as a parent to suggest going to an Illinois institution of higher education because of how this budget has just been a mess. And because of those concerns, as you expressed, what if I get into a program and because of the money woes, it has to get cut? Or because of the money woes, it won't be accredited? And what's my degree worth?
You're impacting people's lives on a daily basis, not just college kids. But think about what the economic impact is. I think the number's $50 billion statewide. But think about in a Macomb or Charleston, what happens when those numbers drop? You end up with less faculty. They're leaving the state of Illinois. Administrative people, support staff. It means the economy in that area suffers. Those people are having problems with keeping their jobs. It impacts mortgage payments. So all of this all of this chaos in Springfield of not having a budget is impacting day-to-day lives in the higher ed field and then, you know, countless other areas. But yeah, but I think there's some serious repercussions that we're about to face in higher ed because and they don't get credit for it, but the university presidents and their boards have done such a good job. We've almost thought there wasn't a problem when in reality it's a very real problem.
Well, and you touched on it as I did Eastern Illinois and Western Illinois. And I mean, let's face it, you know, they are the pillars of those regional economies. And we're talking about a state at this time where the rural economies of the state are you know, slipping away. Downstate Illinois, it's the economy's slipping away.
It's very, yes, and this adds to that drop, and I think a very significant way. DeKalb's the same way as Macomb and Eastern and Carbondale. So, I don't think you can implore the General Assembly that these are very real problems affecting people.
Okay, so now let's look to what happened with the grand bargain talks. That was the proposals led by Democratic Senate President John Cullerton and Senate Republican Leader Christine Redonio in an attempt to try to break this budget stalemate. And we saw them basically collapse. And the Democrats blaming the governor for weighing in on and saying that this didn't meet his threshold of being any kind of a grand bargain. Republicans saying there isn't enough here yet to move forward. There are some valid points. Part of this grand bargain was supposed to be a rewriting of the general state aid formula and the way that schools get, elementary and secondary schools get funded. Also was supposed to be some kind of a agreement on changes in the pension system. All of this having been said, it just seems like this is such a huge package that I don't know that it is politically doable.
Well, first of all, I think the fact that they, you know, normally, as you know, the big items end up being done the last day or two of session. So the fact that they started this conversation this early, to me, is a good sign. I think, you know, these deadlines were self-imposed. There's plenty of time on a legislative calendar. I preface all my comments with it's a mess. It needs to get done yesterday, so I don't want anyone to think, oh, there's no urgency. There's urgency. But from a legislative calendar standpoint, there's time. And it's not uncommon for a big idea, a big concept, to get floated and not go anywhere. And so I believe that they can still get there. And I do think it was good that they started this as early as they did. I think one thing we need to all stop doing, since I've been gone, I've tried to recalculate how I think. We got to quit talking about political winners and losers. All right. I mean, the place is you and I talked off the air, the pictures from Naplate of that tornado and how bad it was. That's a good analogy to what it is in the state of Illinois. And how do we all come together? We're first of all, not all going to get what we want. Okay. And I think,
well, that's the definition of compromise.
That's the definition of compromise. The problem is, one of the problems we have is it is so bad, it's going to be very, very difficult to solve this problem. Legislators, I believe, have to understand when they leave Springfield in May, if they have fixed this in any way, most likely nobody's going to be happy. You know what I mean? In the world of a good compromise, I remember my days in the state's attorney's office when I thought there was a good plea agreement, nobody was happy. And so that's probably going to be, you know, most legislators want to leave. They want instant gratification. They want to feel good about themselves. It's probably not going to happen. So we need to quit talking about winners and losers. We need to realize that we are impacting people's lives on a daily basis. Everybody's going to take some pain. I think the good thing about the grand bargain is, in terms of trying to get this done, is there. You saw Cullerton put in there. He's not there yet, but property tax relief is on the table.
Right.
Not what the governor wants, but at least the thing has been demanding is being discussed. Workers' comp. So the fact that it's there is a good thing. And does that mean at the end of the day they can bridge the gap so we can actually solve the problem? That remains to be seen, but I think it's a good start.
So you believe we'll get there?
I am going to be cautiously optimistic. We have to get there. It is so bad right now in so many levels. We talked about higher ed. You could have somebody come in here and talk about human services, social services, early childhood. The list goes on and on. I am going to be cautiously optimistic because I think it's that dire right now that we need a resolution. And every legislator, I believe, is hearing that on a daily basis.
Just to get a little wonky, one of the things I've thought that might help move this would be some kind of a capital program, some kind of infrastructure program. You're already talking about going to be raising a myriad of taxes. Why not do what we haven't had in a while, which is a capital program? And at least if you're going to take some of these tough votes, you might have a bridge or a road or a railroad crossing that you can point to and say, hey, I at least am trying to get something done.
Look, yes, the answer is yes. To that very point that I mentioned a while ago is where a legislator wants to go home with something positive to say. He or she can talk about property tax relief if that happens. He or she can talk about comp. He or she can talk about paying some bills. But the idea of a capital bill, it does make some sense to that point of giving them something to brag about, so
point
to speak. To point to. And the needs are there. The needs are there. Legitimately, the needs are there on a variety of fronts.
We've been speaking to Tom Cross, the chairman of the Illinois Board of Higher Education, former Illinois House Republican leader. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. We're finishing our discussion with Tom Cross, the former Illinois House Republican leader and the chairman of the Illinois Board of Higher Education. I'm not so sure that you say, let's get the politics out of it. Let's get the blame out of it.
Would be nice.
I just don't know that that's the way the world works anymore.
I think traditionally and historically that has been the case. And you can't ignore the politics. I get that. But I think
back in the day, and you remember, there was the acknowledged need, hey, all right, we gotta do something. We gotta fix it. I think the politics of Washington that has permeated the politics everywhere has come that it's all about winners and losers.
Yep, it is, and it's gotten that way, and it's the rhetoric is caustic, and everything's polarized. But there's nobody in this country. There's not another state in this country going through what we're going through right now, and I think. That's why, in spite of all of that, in spite of the rhetoric and the polarization, if we don't fix this, if the state doesn't fix this, we're going to continue to hurt people in very real ways.
But you likened it to the tornado damage.
Because it is.
But I have to wonder, is it going to take a calamity? A big scale calamity. I just don't know.
Well, let's hope it doesn't get to that point, and that may be what it is, but I think most people, look, the interesting thing about that tornado is how many people showed up to help clean up in Nayplate that weren't from there, and so there's kind of this, everybody comes together. That's what we need in Springfield right now.